The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning and welcome to Campus Voices. I'm Richard Gordon and I'm up in the Special Collections Gallery at the University Library with Rachel Silva. And Rachel, why don't you introduce our guests to the audience?
Hello, yes. We are speaking with Professor Margaret Stetz, May and Robert Carter Professor of Women's Studies and Professor of Humanities, and Mark Samuels Lasner, Senior Research Fellow at the UD Library.
And we're standing in the collection, Victorian Passion, Stories from the Mark Samuels Lasner Collection. Mark, how did you get started collecting things from the 19th century?
Well, I always say that I had a late 19th century childhood in Connecticut. I grew up in a Victorian house living with my grandparents, and I was always keen on the past. One of my childhood memories was meeting a woman named Mary Bradshaw Hayes, who had been born in London in 1880, a friend of my grandmother's. And she told me stories of growing up in the late 19th century. She happened to know through her father, who was a writer and folklorist, Joseph Jacobs, all kinds of literary people. She had known Robert Browning and William Morris and the artist Edward Burne Jones. So I heard firsthand stories about the people who I later came to collect.
There's just a wide variety of things in here, Margaret. I mean, how did you choose what to put in here?
It was surprisingly difficult. Mark has over 9,500 items in the collection, and this exhibition could only have fewer than 100 items because we had to leave room for labels that also explain what you're looking at. We knew that we wanted to tell stories in this exhibition, and I am a storyteller. I think teaching is all about storytelling, and that an exhibition is a narrative. We thought that a good theme would be Victorian passions because the Victorians themselves were a passionate group. They were passionate about many different things, from social reform to art to one another. But this is also an exhibition that highlights Mark Samuels Lasner's passions for the Victorians. We have the passions of the present for the past, and we also have the passions of those creators for making things that they wanted to share both with their contemporaries and, of course, with us.
One of the things that, without the thing, I'm getting lots of popping. That's why I keep putting it off to the side. One of the things that struck me reading about the exhibition, Mark, is that you've got lots of things that actual artifacts that were given from one person to another. And I think that's a really an interesting way of talking about the emotional connections.
Well, I always feel that the stories that the objects, books, manuscripts, artworks tell are absolutely fascinating. One of the things about the Victorians is that they seem to have all known one another. You think of Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Wilde as very famous writers writing completely different things, Sherlock Holmes and Dorian Gray. But in fact, they knew one another, and they were in fact commissioned to write novellas by an American publisher at a dinner in London in 1889. And that's just one particular connection. But the items in the exhibition are selected in part to show those connections. So there is a book given by William Morris, News from Nowhere, to his collaborator and best friend, the painter Edward Burne Jones. There's a book given by Alfred Tennyson, Idylls of the King, presented to the photographer Julia Margaret Cameron, who later created wonderful artistic versions of the stories that are in Idylls of the King, of the Morte d'Arthur. So every item in the exhibition, and in fact many of the items in the collection, show these particular kinds of intimate connections between creators, their friends, their associates, their lovers.
You've also got in here somewhere, don't you, the first work in which Peter Pan appeared?
Yes. Surprisingly, people think of Peter Pan as a play, but the story, the gist of the story, was buried in a number of chapters in a novel by Barry called The Little White Bird, which no one practically has now read. It's actually in some ways unreadable because it's a very, very strange book. But it does, the Peter Pan connection is made very clear when you open the book and you see as the frontispiece a fanciful map of Kensington Gardens, where, of course, the story begins. Barry, in fact, lived in a big house opposite Kensington Gardens. I've been in the house. It's quite magnificent. It's one of the few houses in London to have a front garden that's about a quarter of an acre in size. And the book is pretty much unknown. The copy on display was presented by Barry to his sister, who, in fact, came to the premiere of Peter Pan in 1904.
Margaret, can you take us and show us that?
We have this in a case with some of the best sellers of the late 19th century. The Little White Bird is flanked on two sides by two equally spectacular books. One is Dracula. This is Bram Stoker's novel, which of course made a big splash in its own day and is still making a big bloody splash in ours. This particular copy was presented to a famous actress, Stella Patrick Campbell, who was the originator of Eliza Doolittle.
Yes.
In the first production of Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. The connection here is a fascinating one. She was the lover of the son of the Pre-Raphaelite artist Edward Burne-Jones, Philip Burne-Jones, who was an artist himself. And Philip Burne-Jones did a painting called The Vampire that shows Stella Patrick Campbell as a looming, frightening presence, a kind of succubus figure who's over the body of a man who's lying limp. And she's got his chest bare and there's blood everywhere. I don't think she was too thrilled about that. And this is after they'd broken up. This is how you get revenge. In any case, this is the copy that Bram Stoker gave to her. And in this same case, on the other side, is a copy of the most important art and literature magazine of the 1890s, The Yellow Book, which was associated with decadence. And then in front of those books is a copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's own calling card laid in. But one of the things that I want to point out in looking at a case like this is how radical so many of these works were. You asked earlier, what was the organizing principle for this exhibition? And there is a kind of secret principle, and that has to do with the radical politics behind many of these works. Mark Samuels Lassner's two major areas of collecting are the Pre-Raphaelites and the aesthetes and decadents. These are both groups that were outsider groups. They were the avant-garde. They were the political and artistic fringe. There were many women who were part of these movements. There were many people of dissident sexualities. There were many people who were immigrants and the children of immigrants. The Pre-Raphaelite movement began in 1848 with a kind of breakaway group of artists who wanted to counter the stodgy artistic establishment, but even more, who really wanted to overturn the class system, who were were keen on making alliances with working class people, who got involved in the early socialist movements, and also then the aesthetes and decadents, who were kind of the next generation, were equally revolutionary figures who were interested not in conventional morality, but in creating their own standard of morality based on what they saw as beauty and truth and alliances across all kinds of boundaries. Of course, Oscar Wilde is the most famous figure in the movement of the aesthetes and the decadents, but we have many women represented as well who were part of those movements. Everybody from the lesbian couple who wrote as Michael Field to the Irish New Woman writer George Edgerton, that was her pseudonym. We have a lovely copy of her very radical book of short stories called Keynotes in a copy that she gave to the publisher in a very beautiful cover that she made herself. She did the
that's
needle.
That green.
That's the needle.
Well, let's go look at this.
Cover. Yes. Underneath it is the book that was sold in bookshops with a design by Aubrey Beardsley. And of course, Beardsley wow. himself was a highly divisive and controversial figure. On the yellow book, as you can see, that cover has a Beardsley design. And people were shocked and outraged when they saw this because they thought these were very perverse figures on the yellow book announcing that this whole magazine was going to be a kind of nightmare of moral decay. So Mark collects those kinds of things, and I teach those sorts of things, and I love them.
Rachel, does Margaret bring these things into class? You've had her for a class before.
Yeah, I mean, she brings on a lot of good accounts of what's happening. So last semester, we had a class about women in war. So she brought in a lot of articles and movies and pictures that depicted women writing about war or, you know, living during times of war. So, you know, the information that she brings into class is very useful.
And this coming fall, I'm teaching a new course in women and gender studies under the rubric of feminism and sexualities called Oscar Wilde, Women and Sexualities. That'll be both about Wilde's own day and his own story, but also the legacy of what happened to that story and how his example has been so important for a variety of social and political movements, especially around sexuality.
Mark, one of the things that I think some people forget is just the breadth of the different kinds of literature that was written in the last half of the 19th century. I mean, you've got everything from Gunga Din to Oscar Wilde.
Well, one of the things that's remarkable is the variety of, the wide variety of literature that I've tried to represent in the collection and is somewhat well represented in the exhibition, ranging in form from the popular books in parts, you think of Charles Dickens, to the three-volume novel, which was the standard for serious fiction from the early 19th century to the end of the 1890s, to volumes of poetry, to yellowbacks, which were cheap popular fiction, to pamphlets. The sheer difference in physical form and the kinds of contents is simply remarkable. Victorian literature as we read it today tends to be in a kind of standard paperback form or an online ebook, but in its day, just the way the books looked is so remarkable. You could tell from the physical presence of a work what kind of thing was going to be inside, whether it was going to be a popular work sold cheaply, printed cheaply, whether it was to appeal to a more intellectual audience. The kind of binding designs vary from the very bland to the outrageous ones of the artists and illustrators of the 1890s, such as Aubrey Beardsley. The exhibition includes a wide range of works, ranging from, in a sense, first editions of famous works of literature to some quite unexpected items, including Beatrix Potter's first published illustrations, which are in a little kind of gift book intended for the Christmas season of 1893 called A Happy Pair.
And that would be, oh wow.
Yes.
That's
and
little.
Across from it on the wall is an original Beatrix Potter drawing, one that isn't reproduced very often, of rabbits gathering apples. And they're rabbits wearing little jackets. That's what you usually expect with Beatrix Potter, just as you see in The Happy Pair, where they've got their clothes and they've got their little umbrella. And we've put that next to a Kate Greenaway book. I love Kate Greenaway as a marvelous illustrator who popularized aesthetic style for girls and for boys as well, but especially for girls.
What did she popularize? And when you talk about aesthetic style specifically,
well, you can see in this copy the kind of Regency dress of dressing little children in costumes that harkened back to an earlier era. The aesthetes believed that contemporary Victorian life was ugly. They were against the exploitation of workers in industry and mass production. They wanted to return to an idea of handicrafts. They wanted to return to what they saw as a kind of more beautiful past. And Kate Greenaway took that idea and brought it into the world of children. Of course, the commercial interests in the end of the 19th century saw a wonderful marketing opportunity and then turned out cheap, industrial, mass-produced versions of aesthetic fashion for children and sold them in the new department stores that were created in the late Victorian period. So aestheticism became a commodity as well. But here you see it in its purer form as really something beautiful and meant to teach small children about the beauty of flowers, of nature, of design, of a kind of idealized world, different from the miseries of industrialism.
Rachel Silva and I are up in the Special Collections Gallery on the second floor of the library, talking with Professor Margaret Stets, May and Robert Carter, Professor of Women's Studies and a Professor of Humanities, and with Mark Samuels Lasner, Senior Research Fellow here in the library. And we're walking around the Victorian Passions, stories from the Mark Samuels Lasner collection exhibition here. And Mark, I see there also on the wall right behind you, there looks like there are some caricatures and sort of funny drawings.
Yes, I'm a great fan of the work of Max Beerbohm, who was the leading caricaturist in Britain from the 1890s to the 1930s. He was also a essayist, novelist, wit, radio broadcaster, and a dandy. And if there's any one figure in the collection with whom I feel particularly close, it's Max Beerbohm. And he had a very, very wicked sense of humor. Always civilized, but sometimes very nasty. And the caricatures on the wall are of figures such as Joseph Conrad, Henry James, Kipling, Oscar Wilde, and Max Beerbohm himself. He was his own target in many, many of his caricature drawings. There's also a book that he had, as he called it, improved, which meant he went over the illustrations and wrote phony inscriptions and notes in them. And it's a book by Queen Victoria. And here he's taken the frontispiece, portrait of Victoria, and changed it so that Queen Victoria really looks like a piece of furniture more than anything else. That book is next to a manuscript by Beerbohm and another improved book, his book of parodies, A Christmas Garland, which has a caricature of Robert Browning and the playwright Ibsen, who in an imaginary scene are being introduced to one another by the writer Edmund Gosse. And the joke, of course, is that neither Browning nor Ibsen spoke a common language, so Gosse had to translate between the two. And of course, this is a completely imaginary story. And at one point, Ibsen gives the opinion that no woman could possibly be a great poet. And Gosse is shown by Beerbohm as having to try to translate that to the husband of Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
And we have Elizabeth Barrett Browning on the other side of the room, a lovely photograph of her, a photograph of her as well with their son, and her long poetic narrative, Aurora Leigh. Aurora Leigh, which was a very important poetic statement about women's rights and about Elizabeth Barrett Browning's own objections to the treatment of so-called fallen women, of women who were sexually active, in this case, a character who bears a child out of wedlock. Above that case, on the right, is another Max Beerbohm cartoon that connects with one of the lovely things that we've got in this exhibition, and that is the story of Elizabeth Siddal. Elizabeth Siddal was a working-class young woman, worked in a hat shop when she was discovered by the Pre-Raphaelite artists. She became the model and muse and later the wife of Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the poet and painter. We have Max Beerbohm's kind of jokey version many, many decades later of what they must have been like in their so-called courtship. And the joke is he's drawn them as though they were kind of aristocratic, reserved, stodgy figures. They certainly were not. One of the most interesting things in the exhibition not only has to do with Elizabeth Siddal, but comes directly from Elizabeth Siddal, and that is a lock of her hair. The story was that she was very ill. She was taking drugs, laudanum, an opiate, and that she overdosed. Whether this was a deliberate overdose or an accidental overdose, nobody can prove. But at the age of 32, she died, and Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who was at that point her husband, was bereft. He was overcome. He took the manuscript of the poems he had written and he put them in her coffin and had it sealed up and had her buried. Before he did so, however, he snipped off a lock of her beautiful red hair, which he had painted many times in his marvelous oil paintings and watercolors. And this is an actual lock of her hair with a note by him, next to a proof copy of the volume of poems that resulted when, 7 years later, he decided he really wanted to publish those poems, so he had her dug up, and he had the manuscript exhumed from her grave. So we've got the hair, and then we've got the volume of poems that resulted. Behind us, though, is a nice reminder that she wasn't just a model. She was a working class girl who was a very quick study, who learned how to write and how to draw. She became a poet herself and she became an artist. And we have one of her own works of art. On either side are two images of her. One is by Barbara Bodichon, who was a Victorian feminist, a supporter of women's higher education, women owning their own property. And she was also a really good artist. We have this very idealized portrait of Elizabeth Siddal on one side of Elizabeth Siddal's own work of art. And on the other side is a little sketch of Elizabeth Siddal by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, by her husband. So we've got those three things together looking across at the hair.
Mark, there's got to be a story on how you came upon this lock of hair.
It came from the collection of a scholar academic named William Fredeman, who was a professor at the University of British Columbia and had known a number of the descendants of the Pre-Raphaelites. And I had the opportunity to purchase a lot of material from his collection, including a kind of album of miscellaneous letters, ephemera, photographs, and I bought this almost sight unseen. I really didn't know what was in it. And I was in British Columbia and got this back to my hotel room and started going through it bit by bit. And suddenly I was confronted with a little plastic bag with red hair and a note in Rossetti's handwriting that says, "Lizzie's hair, February 1862. I couldn't believe what I was actually seeing. I had no idea that it was in existence. I'm, of course, waiting to see how cloning works, because we're thinking maybe we'll all live long enough to see another Elizabeth Siddal.
Over here, I was actually looking at this book that seems to be in Italian by Lewis Carroll. I'm assuming it's Alice in Wonderland in Italian.
It is a translation. Mark, do you want to explain
yes.
the connection?
It's the first Italian edition of Alice, and Alice has been translated into roughly 200 languages, and it is possibly the most translated book except for the Bible. This is a translation published with Carroll's assent. And what is interesting is the translator was a first cousin of Dante Gabriel and Christina Rossetti. And this copy was given by the translator to Christina Rossetti. So it has a kind of Rossetti association as well as the Lewis Carroll interest. There's a very nice little feature in the book that's minute, but for Tenniel's illustration of the Mad Hatter, you may remember that there's a ticket with the price of the hat. Mm-hmm. In this edition, and only in this edition, the price is given in lira.
I've just got to ask, what is that over there that looks like Whistler's mother?
That's Aubrey Beardsley, who was an inveterate joker and prankster. And that is a letter that he wrote to a friend of his, an illustrated letter, in which he says that he has gone to visit the painting arrangement in gray and white. That is Whistler's mother. And then he redraws it with himself as Whistler's mother. It's a marvelous kind of gender-bending image, and it's so perfectly Aubrey Beardsley.
And next to it looks like an edition of Hedda Gabler.
Yes, Elizabeth Robbins' copy. Elizabeth Robbins, who starred in the first production of Hedda Gabler in English and who was instrumental in getting it translated. This area is the theater case. We have William Morris fabric as curtains to sort of announce that this is the theater case. And my favorite item in the collection is below, and that is this beautiful souvenir scroll that was given out to the people who attended the banquet in honor of Ellen Terry on the anniversary of her 50th year as a stage performer. The artist William Nicholson did this lovely scroll. It's in two parts. It came in the little box that's in the center. And it shows from left to right all of her stage roles from the time that she was a child performer right up to the year of this celebration in 1906. And she became, I should say, a very strong supporter of women's suffrage, getting votes for women.
Well, Mark, this is just remarkable. Do you have a specific thing you want to make sure that we tell people about before we sign off?
Well, I think it's important to say the exhibition has now been extended till June 30th in the Special Collections Gallery on the second floor of Morris Library. Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and on Wednesdays till 8 o'clock in the evening.
Thank you so much, Mark Samuels-Lasner and Margaret Stetz.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark. or online at wvud.org.